Hey, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Rusik Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to people in the local music scene and beyond.
Today we have Mark Thornton, country music veteran and one of the best guitar players here in town in Nashville. He owns his own studio, Sidekick Sound.
If you like what we're doing here, head on over to our YouTube page where you can watch and listen to live performances that we have every week with each one of our guests.
Subscribe and give us a follow.
Check it out. Yeah, because so when did you move to Nashville?
I moved to Nashville in 92.
92, okay.
Yeah, from L.A.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wait, so where are you from originally?
I'm from Iowa.
Iowa, okay. Yeah. I had no idea.
Middle of the United States.
Yeah.
Midwesterner.
So what got you, before getting out here, what got you out to L.A.?
In high school, or junior high and high school, I was in a band.
Okay.
It was a rock band that I went out there with from high school.
Mm-hmm.
was out there for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. Finally came to Nashville in 92.
First of all, I can't even imagine what the difference between LA now versus then. But what was the catalyst for making the change from there to Nashville once you decided to?
Nashville's just too big of a city, but I liked. I mean, LA was too big of a city,
yeah.
but I liked LA.
It's a fun city. Like anytime I'm out there, Brian and I kind of joke around and poke fun at it. But anytime I am out there, I do have a fun time. Like it is a nice city. I think a lot of it is just the people is the big thing, and like I'm not a city guy in general.
I've never liked it there.
Yeah.
Every time I'm leaving LA, I'm always like,
thank you,
thank God.
All right, fine.
The weather's perfect.
It is.
I think the weather's great, but I think it's like. Definitely the traffic is a big one. Like you spend like 90% of your day sitting in traffic. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Let's move the weather to Nashville and
exactly.
This would be the perfect city.
I
in the last handful of years that we've been here, I grew up all over the place. I never lived in Tennessee though, so this was a new state for me. I really do enjoy Nashville immensely, but I really think I've fallen in love with Tennessee. I mean, that's what's keeping me here. I think it's
beautiful here.
It's a beautiful state,
especially driving around the country and stuff. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it really, really. Oh, and if I was trying to get up on the, when you're talking to Mike, trying to do like a fistful away, we're so bad with telling people. We had Timbo in here like a while ago and like, you know, Timbo.
He's talking, a wild card.
Brian and I are looking, he's like, Jesus, we're going to be having
some. You
got to
keep Timbo on the paper. Stay on the paper, Timbo.
Exactly. But no, it is. I really do think it is Tennessee that's kept me here at this point. Just as much as Nashville has, as great as Nashville is, it is a really, really beautiful state. And the people here are really great. That was my big thing with California is the people more so than the environment itself. Cause I think as a state, it's stunning. I grew up all over, primarily in the South as a kid though. Like I was born in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, you know, mm-hmm. all over the place. And I think it's a sort of East Coast, Southern, just forwardness. Like people all over the country are generally really kind and forward and want to talk to you. And California is a little different. At least the part of California that I lived in is, as much as I love going back to visit, it is a very different.
Yeah.
It's a different thing.
Venice Beach is the first place I landed.
Very nice.
I guess I was 18 or something like that. Mm-hmm.
That's very.
We drew straws. This is in high school. You know, we had to leave Iowa and go somewhere for our music. It was either L.A., New York, mm-hmm. you know, Nashville,
the exact
Chicago.
Same three that we chose from.
ended up being Los Angeles.
Nice.
That's pretty much us, except we just chose Nashville first.
Yeah.
Okay.
We thought very, very similar situation. We thought about L.A., we thought about New York, and then we came out here for a trip just to check it out. Neither of us had ever been to Nashville before. Came out here for maybe a handful of days and really enjoyed it. And we said, yeah, let's do Nashville, and kind of haven't looked back since then. It's been a wild ride, and I feel like so much of life, I'm an idiot, but I feel like so much of life just kind of happens. You don't even really plan for it in a way, and we just met so many nice people and just kind of worked itself out somehow. But
it's the best city. I love this town. I'll stay here and I'll die here, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How long you been here? Like what
whatever it is, 92.
Okay.
What year are we in? Yeah,
2025. I'm still not used to saying the year. It takes me like the first 4 months of the year to actually remember what year.
Nashville has seen like a obviously massive change in recent years. How do you feel about all that? Overall positive or negative? Or
Mainly positive.
That's good. Yeah.
I mean, there's both sides of the coin, I guess. But it's a different town everywhere. Every time I go somewhere, it's a new thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never seen this before. I don't have to go anywhere.
Yeah, it's nice. It just changes around you.
It just changes around you.
What, so when you were starting off, first of all, when did you first get into music? When did that bug get in there? Because I feel like that happens at different points for people, but it's usually gets under your skin pretty young.
Yeah, I had older brothers. I'm the youngest.
Okay.
And I had older brothers. A couple of them played, and one of them really played, and he's the one who got me started and taught me.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
my brother Steve.
Very nice.
He's the oldest. He never quite really did anything with it, but he went to San Antonio. San Antonio, and went to jazz school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And came back, and I learned
everything. Was he a guitar player?
Guitar player. Okay. I learned everything I could from him. He, I remember him bringing home a book called Nashville Guitar. Mm-hmm. By Arlen Roth.
Okay.
I think it's out of print now. But there's a chapter in there on how to play finger style, like Merle Travis style. I don't have the book anymore. It's basically like Merle Travis style.
Very cool.
How to play Nine Pan Hammer, I'm a Pilgrim. And the first thing I learned. And that he learned how to play that, and I thought that was the greatest thing I've ever heard. You know,
guitar is just, it's such a beautiful accompanying instrument. I think it's just, it's... I'm always in awe of what people can do with a guitar, because from a design standpoint, it's such a beautiful supporting instrument. But it's so wonderful with playing melody and with being able to support a melody and harmony at the same time. If you know what you're doing,
it's one of the most versatile instruments.
It really is.
For sure.
It really,
yeah.
Really
you
is.
Can comp. You can you can play solos. You can. You can play, you can play a rhythm on it. You can do everything you need to in a band.
It is. It's the like Swiss Army knife of instruments.
Like a keyboard, like a piano is.
Exactly.
Nothing against. I mean, you can do that with a steel and a fiddle, but guitar, you can really comp and play. You know,
and there's something.
It ain't like you lay out and you wait for your turn to play. You know,
and there's also. I just think there's also something kind of romantic and beautiful about it being some. It's something you can carry with you. Whereas a piano, I do most of my writing on piano. I'm not really a trained piano player, but I do a lot of writing on piano. But there's something really wonderful about the portability of a guitar. The fact that anywhere I go, I can take this thing with me.
Yeah.
Whereas a piano, you're kind of handcuffed to it a little bit.
Yeah. But what'd they do in the 1800s, I guess they...
Yeah, exactly.
Took a piano on the covered wagon.
Yeah, exactly, right? I always think about that. I think like... Can you imagine how exciting that would have been for any town the first time you had a piano set up? That's a big deal to have a piano in town. That's got to be a big day for everyone.
At the local honky tonk.
Yeah.
That's probably where that
started. Yeah. I think little things like that just, because I'm fascinated really by the history of music and how those things transpire. I always think little things like that have to be just, that was an exciting day for someone. So at that point, what was the music that was calling you? So how old were you when you went out to LA initially?
Straight out of school, straight out of high school. We all graduated, and I had to work a few months. My brothers had a grocery store, so I worked for them to earn enough money to take the trip to LA. Yeah. You know, so. I was 18.
Okay. Did you know anyone out there, or was it just, I'm going out to play music?
Nobody.
Oh, that's...
Yeah. Yeah, except the band, you know.
Yeah.
Two of them went first.
Okay.
And then I followed suit, and they got a job working at on the beach, Venice Beach, working at a frozen yogurt shop. So all four of us in the band ended up getting a job working at the frozen yogurt shop on Venice Beach.
That's great. Yeah, those are the things in life that I'm always impressed by, frankly, when people take the risk to do things like that. Even as a young person who doesn't know any better. I mean, God knows when I was that age, I was doing equally stupid things. But like, I think that's such a beautiful thing when people take those risks and decide that, no, this is what I want to do with my life. Because music is such a strange, strange pursuit to give your life to.
Yeah. It just happens organically.
Yeah.
I never went to college or anything. It just learned from playing in bands.
When you got out there, what was the music scene like in LA at that time?
This is the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So whatever was going on then, Dwight Yoakam, I think, was still big.
Okay.
The place I didn't know about until later was called the Palomino Club.
Okay.
And that's where I basically met the bulk of the musicians from the scene.
Gotcha.
There, and I finally found my people. I think it was Monday nights. They had the talent night. Cliffy Stone, who was he produced like Merle Travis and Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Okay.
But he was the MC of the talent
night
at the Palomino Club on, I think it was Mondays. And that was cool. So I met people there. And then every Tuesday was the barn dance, Ronnie Mack's barn dance.
Mm.
You know, you'd have people like Dale Watson, Jeffrey Steele, Rosie Flores. There was a whole scene there, you know. It's kind of like the scene on Tuesdays here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, comparable kind of thing.
Yeah, way before that happened.
That's amazing.
I think it was a Tuesday night, yeah.
That's funny.
Palomino Club.
Who, at that point in your life, when you are, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, you're out in L.A., what's the music that you're listening to every day? What's the music that has you enthralled?
I loved classic country, you know, and there was a radio station that was the coolest radio station out there. I ended up getting affiliated with KCSN Northridge.
Okay.
And there were 24-hour traditional country music for like a few years. So I ended up getting a radio show of my own on there in the middle of the night.
That's cool.
That's amazing, yeah.
Was there a big scene for that sort of classic country stuff at that time in LA?
Yeah, kind of like here right now. It's just a circle of people that...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things that I'm always kind of reminding myself is the traditional country scene here isn't as big as I think it is in my head, you know? Because it's what I'm just sort of exposed to here and what I tend to spend a lot of my time with. So
yeah.
I think I'm inflating it in my head as to how big it is, but it is quite insulated. It is quite small, really, in the grand scheme of things, at least.
Yeah, yeah. You know, most people come to town, they don't know anything about country music, mm-hmm. and they want to go to Tootsie's or something like that, you know, and they see a steel guitar for the first time, so they ask, what is that instrument,
what is it?
You know? So it makes you realize that you're just, you know, just...
Yeah. But there's something beautiful about that, too, I think. I think there is something really wonderful about being the stewards of a particular kind of music, whatever it is. And I think there are some people out here who really take that seriously and really respect the idea of being able to show this music to people. Cause there's something really valuable in that, I think.
Yeah. I think most people dig it, you know, once they get into it.
When you get dance into it, it's hard not to love it.
Yeah.
And I really think some of the greatest songwriting that this country has produced comes from that kind of music as well. I think there's just some phenomenal songwriting in that vein of music
and the group the Cowpokes, you know, the Cowpokes.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I think they've done a great great deal of service to traditional country music.
Totally.
To young people who don't know anything about it, you know. Mm-hmm. I assume.
Yeah, absolutely.
They see the dancing.
Yeah.
And they start to pick up on what this is.
And the presentation of it as well with them is done so well.
Yeah.
I love that it...
They're all good-looking guys, you know, and they dress...
they dress the part,
real
yeah.
well, you know. I need to learn from that.
Same, you and me both. But I do think there's really something great about them in particular, because it's not... for them, they're kind of all over the place with what they're playing in the best way possible, where... I never feel as though they've kind of pigeonholed themselves into, okay, we're only going to play this specific subset of country music. they do a little bit of everything, and I think they do a really wonderful job of presenting country music as a whole to people who may not ever be exposed to it.
Yeah.
Where you could kind of, I could quickly see a scenario where a band like that kind of, again, pigeonholes themselves into, we're only doing music of this particular era in this particular style, where they're kind of all over the place. It's nice to see them embrace that, I think.
Yeah. They're the gate. I think of them as the gate cowpokes or the gateway.
Yes.
Drug.
Exactly.
You know, to classic country music.
They really, really are. Yeah. That's a good, we need more roles like that in the world. You know, it's nice. It's definitely nice. So when you were, you're playing in that scene in LA, what was, why did you feel like you needed to take that leap at that point to come out here? What was the reasoning behind that?
I probably would have stayed out there. I don't know. I always loved Nashville. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to be here. I had a girlfriend. I met her at the Gene Autry Western Heritage Museum.
We all have.
And then she and her mom, her mother came out here. And then I followed suit. You know, it's like, well, I'm going to move out to Nashville, you know.
Fantastic.
You know, so it was meant to be.
Yeah, that's
wonderful. I finally got here because I knew somebody. I knew her, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. That kind of thing you do oftentimes need some kind of light to be shooting towards. It can be hard if you don't have that. When you got out here, this is kind of piggybacking off a little bit of what Brian said earlier, but how was the music scene in Nashville at that time? Because we've been here 6 years and change, so it really hasn't changed that much at all since we've been here. I mean, it has, but nothing substantial. Nothing, I'm sure, like what you or others have seen. So when you got out here, what was the state of it? Was there more of the traditional country scene, or was that taken over?
I don't remember this particular scene going on, but it was 90s country.
Yeah.
So I got into a band that went on the road.
Okay.
We played the top 40 country, 90s country music at the time.
Hey, there's some great 90s country.
Oh,
there's
sure.
Some fantastic country in the 90s, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Nice. And then, so, at this point, Brian was also saying this earlier before I think we started rolling, but you've been mentioned a lot on this show just because you are so involved in this scene here in various ways. I think that's such a beautiful thing, is you are so, I do really see you much as the same way you were describing the cowpokes, as very much a steward for this music. And you have really been, wonderful at, it seems to me, really bringing a lot of people in to this kind of music and helping in a lot of different ways, not just as a musician, but through recording and producing and all of that. So when you, once you got out here and kind of found your footing, one of the things that I think people really know you for around here is playing guitar for Jerry Reed and doing that.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is you started doing that, what, 97, somewhere around there?
Yeah, you're right.
How did you get into that? How did that world open up to you? Cause that's kind of the stuff of, as silly as it sounds, that's kind of the stuff of legend here. I mean, that's a big honor and something that I think you're very proud of and you should be. It's like, how the heck did that happen?
Well, I need to thank, I never talked to him, but I need to thank him. Pat Flynn, it was a guitar player I had I was doing these Pickin' On records. That's another story, you know, with the CMA records.
Now I want to hear about this.
But anyway, at the end of the day session, I guess he knew that I played thumb style, you know, like Chet.
Yeah.
And he just asked me, you know, I heard that Jerry's looking for a thumb style guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be interested in me telling his band leader about it? So that's how I got that. I don't remember if I called Bobby, his band leader, or if he called me, but I did an audition.
Okay.
For Bobby Lovett, who played with Jerry Reed, and then he thought I was good enough to take over to Jerry's house and then audition for Jerry, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in his kitchen or something like that. We just
what was that like?
Talked and played, you know. Oh man, I just
I gotta imagine that was nerve wracking.
You know, Jerry was one of my guitar heroes, mm-hmm. and so if I don't get this gig, you know, I don't know what I'm gonna do. Yeah. And this is I gotta get this gig.
Yeah.
This would be so cool. And anyway, I just inched my way in and kept the position.
That's beautiful.
Nice.
When you got in, what was the lineup looking like in terms of his band? So what was who were you playing with at that point?
Yeah.
Or what was the instrumentation like? Is probably a better way of asking that.
Yeah, it was basically he wanted to go back to being a guitar band again.
Okay.
So it was basically like the three of us, like Jerry, Bobby Lovett, and me, would pull out our guitars and do some of his instrumentals and mm-hmm. you know, some of his arrangements. So it was basically guitar driven. Then his wife played piano, Prissy. Mm-hmm. She played keys and drums and bass. Bart Pike on bass at that time. Bobby, Johnny Mills on drums. And I think that's the band right there.
That had to be such, I mean, I'm sure at that point you already had some chops, I'm sure, to be in that band. But that had to be such a wonderful learning experience to be exposed to all that music and to be able to, I mean, to even just have him be able, like, to be able to show you that song that you played earlier and to be able to sit down and like show you that arrangement, like, here's what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. That had to be unbelievable. Like what was that like for you to have that be your day job, for lack of a better?
Oh yeah, I would have done it for free.
Yeah,
you know, it's like going to college. You know, I didn't want to tell him that, but I needed money.
Smart,
gotta act cool. But
I still would have done it for free to play with Jerry Reed. You know,
that's amazing.
But he was great to tour with, great to hang around with. He was just a fun guy to be around. You always wanted to be in the same vicinity as Jerry was, in the same room when you're on the road. It's like. That's where all the fun is.
That's another thing I wanted to ask you is there is sort of that trope of, you know, don't meet your heroes and that kind of thing. But the people that I know in life who have, I think especially because in music, there is this binding glue of something that we all love, which is music, and that obsession with music. In my life, I find the people that have met their heroes and have worked with them in a professional setting in some way, it's the greatest thing that ever happened to them. And for you, how did you feel about that? How did you feel about going into a situation where, like, I can't imagine being in the room with that man, let alone like, oh, like my job is to make something with him. I can't fathom that. What was that like for you?
Well, just hanging around him. The first year was really, I was kind of nervous around him. I was pretty shy. I didn't really say anything. Mm-hmm. I didn't say a word, you know. We'd be like on the bus, he'd be on the couch, I'd be in the chair, you know, going down the road and knee to knee, you know. And I would never say anything, you know. Finally, he asked me if, you know, son, do you not like me? So, you know, the guy stepped in and said, no, he loves you. He respects you, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is.
And I think that's a great way to do it, because I'm sure that it's a hard situation to be in, because you want to be professional and you want to respect that person and show that, like, hey, like I'm here for a reason. But I think that's such a wonderful thing.
Yeah,
that's really beautiful.
Yeah, it took at least a year or so before I could, you know,
because you were in there for the better part of 10 years, right? More than that, I'm probably 10 or 11
10 years.
Yeah,
11 years if you go up to when he passed. Mm-hmm. You know,
so what was how did your relationship to him and the music change over that period of time? Do you feel like you were, by the end of it, obviously you knew him far, far better than when you first got in that gig, obviously. How did that affect the playing role, like the way you served the music? Do you feel like that affected it at all? Just kind of getting to know those tunes inside and out and getting to actually know him as a man, as opposed to just this incredible
just
musician.
Getting to know him was a big deal for me, you know. But it's like going to college, mm-hmm. you know, for me.
Yeah.
You know, I had a certain level of skills, you know, before I came in the band, but, you know, just hearing him play and learning stuff from him.
Yeah.
It was like going to school.
I'm sure that's just amazing.
You need another beer, Mark, or are you good?
I'm still working on this one.
Okay.
I think that's such a wonderful thing. So another thing that I kind of wanted to add, I feel like I'm kind of leaping around a little bit right now, but another thing I wanted to ask you, because I just think is of what you are, putting into the Nashville music scene right now, a big part of your contribution right now is the studio. When did all of that start to come to fruition? Like, when did that actually start to happen? When did you decide, I want to make a studio?
Well, it happens slowly. It happens organically, because you can't afford to buy all that stuff.
We're currently in the process of that at the moment, and it's not cheap.
No, it's not. When I was in LA, I had a contact with a record label, David Harley from CMH Records.
Okay.
Kept that contact, and then when I moved here, he got a hold of me, and he already did one or two of these Pickin' On records. He had a business model that they came up with.
Gotcha.
And so I kind of got on board with that. He asked me if I wanted to produce. I think the first one was Pickin' On Christmas.
Okay.
And then we did Pickin' On the Eagles, and then it just kind of evolved. And I've done so many of
them. Were you spending a lot of your time at that point working in the set, working in sessions and working as a studio player, or was it more just gigging?
No, I was just gigging. Okay. I was going elsewhere and on the road with different bands.
Because that's one thing that I've found in Nashville that, from my understanding at least, has changed quite a bit is, from what I understand, back in the day, Nashville was a little bit more segmented off, where you had people who were more studio people, and then you had people who were more the players around town. And now, now again, I don't know how much of that is accurate. That's just kind of what I've been told over the years. But now it seems like it's a little bit more of a mix. Everyone kind of does, just by necessity, a little bit of everything. So
yeah,
I was always curious if you had your foot in that session world, or if that just wasn't your thing.
I did a few sessions. People would call you and play on their project, but not like some of these guys are real session players, But the studio thing just kind of happened through CMH. You buy one microphone, buy a preamp, and the Corner Music was a big thing for me. I would go buy the latest thing, and it was like a drug, Now you got to have it, so now you got to put it on your credit card.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Just to jump back to the LA thing for a second, because I'm curious, what did you find the biggest differences were between the approach to music in LA at that time versus Nashville? Was there a difference in just the way that musicians kind of handle themselves professionally and how they what their day to day was like, or was it pretty comparable?
I don't know. It's harder to make a living in LA. Everything's so expensive.
Yeah. So definitely still that way.
Yeah. So you have to have a job. I had to have a regular job, and then play. But it's just a different. I like Nashville because it's more down home, and you see that in the session world.
Yeah,
people are more relaxed. You're not producing. The producer's not producing every single note. Mm-hmm.
And there's some. I do think. Oh, sorry.
You hire a player, the play, because they just hire them because they do their thing.
Exactly.
You don't have to like microscopically.
Yeah. Yeah. When we had,
That.
I adore that. We had Sweet Meg on here, not too long ago. And we were talking about one of the things I was really, really wanted to pick her brain about was the difference in approach between the New York scene now contemporarily and the Nashville scene, because there's always been sort of a not a rivalry, but there's always been a really different approach between those two places, and for her it's great because she was saying she gets the best of both worlds, where she can bring on people from both to work in her stuff. But there is really that it's a different sort of cultural approach to how people deal with things, and I agree. I think the business model, if you want to call it that, that Nashville has is fantastic. Cause I feel much the same way. It's like, if I bring in a guitar player or a steel player, whomever, I want them in there because I want them to sound like that person.
And, yeah.
And if I wanted to direct something or, you know, orchestrate something in a different way, then what's the point of having that person in the room?
Oh yeah, because you know? Some people are still alive. You know, so can you play like, you know, like harmonica?
Yeah.
Can you play like Charlie McCoy?
Yeah. It's like I'll get Charlie. I'll call Charlie McCoy. He'll show up.
Charlie McCoy. He'll come over here. He's still around.
I would lose my mind if I had Charlie McCoy in here doing this, because I would love to pick his brain. But there's so many awesome. Like there's so many just so many people like that around here that are still around and just making great music and are doing what they've always done, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. I'm a big solo. Like my thing lately has been solo guitar. I do a little more in like the jazz vein. So like kind of Joe Pass style stuff.
Oh,
but
great.
What like so yeah, I love what you just did there. What like how much of that is like a fleshed out arrangement, and how much of that is kind of just improvising off the cuff?
Some of it's arranged, but with the mistakes are, I meant for those mistakes to be in there too.
Yeah.
And the tuning is all meant to happen. No, just kidding. like King of the Road, if we end up using that.
Yeah.
That's arranged. I arranged that a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I've got other stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
That was good for me to be able to try to pull that off.
It sounded great. I loved it on the both the electric and the gut string you did for it. So it sounded really, really great on both ways.
But yeah, I think guitar is such a difficult instrument to play solo on unaccompanied. I think it just wasn't really meant for that, which is why I love trying to do it so much. It's like the challenge of it is
a lot of it does feel like putting a square peg in a round hole when you do that, but when you do it's the best feeling.
Totally.
I mean, you
think about like a piano player, like they got two hands to do two separate things. Like as a guitar player, you got to coordinate doing everything. Like you got two hands, but they're kind of doing one thing, and you have to do both things on each hand. You know what I mean? It's
Again, it comes back to just the functionality of the instrument is so different, and
you get the same note like three times,
yeah.
You know, or four times, you know,
yeah,
E, you know, there's different ways of playing the same thing, yeah. You know,
and that's why when people can be so. And I absolutely lump you into this basket. When people can be so fluid with the instrument as to internalize it in a way in which they can improvise and speak it as they do it. Like someone like Julian Lage, who when he's playing, yes, there's an arrangement there, but he can, much like yourself, bring something else out of it in the moment. I think it's just a magical thing when people can do that with guitar. Because like you're saying, Brian, it is a very different... It's a very different instrument in that way than other things.
It's hard to play solo guitar.
It really is.
I don't have my hands on it enough to be able to pull off.
Well, you fooled us.
Well, I could have done a lot better job, but you have to be sitting there with your hands on it for like hours. And,
totally.
And I fail in that department.
What, what is your... practice routine like, because I know Brian and I talk about this ad nauseum, but there are moments in life, the phases in life, if you will, where it kind of ebbs and flows. I mean, as a kid, when I first started getting obsessed with guitar, I mean, it was an unhealthy amount of time every day that I had that fucking thing in my hands. And there's different points in life, I think, where for everyone, you spend more time with it for purposes of necessity or otherwise. What's your relationship with it at this point in life?
Yeah, I don't spend the many hours like I did when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the bulk of what I know is from then, you know. But I've learned a few things since then. But you know, when you don't have a job and you're going through school, junior high, you know.
It's a lot easier to find the time, yeah.
Yeah, and you say, Mom, I'd like to... I feel sick today. I need to stay home.
Nice. Yeah.
And I want to, so I end up practicing, you know, because I haven't learned this lick yet. So.
I did a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
playing hooky from school.
Oh, sorry. This way. Okay.
Throughout the years, like what, like when you did practice, like what would you say was like the bulk of what you did? Like just you know, listening to records and trying to pick out stuff off that, or were you very like, you know, theory oriented? Did you like learn a lot of scales and stuff like that, or like
what? A little bit later on? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I would learn tunes, you know, and learn licks off the records.
Okay.
You have to kind of earn it, you know, by listening to it with a needle, you know. Now you go to YouTube and learn anything. So
incredible.
It's incredible.
I think about that all the time because I have a bunch of, I have a record collection. I love listening to vinyl, but, you know, when I'm, you know, trying to learn my licks from my favorite players or whatever, I have YouTube and I can skip back 5 seconds by like a click of a button. I can't even imagine, like, you know, when all there was vinyl and you have to keep moving the needle back and...
Oh, yeah, you had to... You really had to earn it.
Yeah.
You know? But YouTube is great for anything.
It even has an option to slow it down half speed, and it makes it so much easier.
One of the things that always blew my... Because, you know, a lot of what I did as a kid was, you know, CDs and stuff like that, you know. But when I was in college, I studied with Paul Rochelle. He was a phenomenal... phenomenal blues guitar player. Him and his wife, who Annie Raines, who's a great harmonica player. I would take lessons with him, and he would show me all these really just amazing blues tunes. And his right hand is just unbelievable. And Paul's I'm trying to think how old Paul is now, but he's getting up there and still incredible musician, but he would talk about trying to learn some of these tunes when, you know, it's not just listening on a record on a vinyl where you got to pull the needle back, but you're listening to through all of this static, just the worst record. I mean, the recordings I adore, but just the worst quality recordings you can imagine, trying to get this one moment of what the hell is happening right now. I can't hear it. Yeah. And I used to think like that, the fact that that's how you learn these songs, no wonder you're so goddamn good at it, because
it's good ear training too.
It's phenomenal ear training. And just to think like, how did you get this, you know, whatever tune it might be, how did you figure that part out? I was like, no, I just had to listen to it 500 times and I couldn't hear it over the static. And finally I figured it out. I was like, I'm never going to forget this.
Yeah.
It's like, I think that's such a skill set, and that doesn't come from nowhere. That comes from just sitting with something for a very, very long time.
You're desperate. You're
exactly. Desperate. Yeah. That's definitely not the easy route to take. For another thing I wanted to ask you about too was the show truck that you've got. Where did that all come from? how did that all start?
just a concept. I've got a bunch of ideas. I just the hard part is actually pursuing it and doing it. And that's a hard one to do because it's physically, you know, you got to.
Yeah, that's an investment.
It's a 1937 old farm truck. You know, it takes a lot, burns a lot. You have to burn a lot of calories to drive it. You know,
yeah,
and take the rails off. And
what was the starting point for that? Like, how did that thought enter your head that you wanted to try that?
There was a cool scene in this movie. Jerry Lee Lewis was in a high school confidential. He's got a piano up on top. You know, with his band, and they're traveling, or they're going down the street, or by the high school, you know.
Yeah.
He's playing the piano. I thought that was the coolest thing. And I think they use those old trucks, you know, for stages, for parking lot shows. You know, you'd see Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, kind of a thing of the 50s. I thought it'd be fun to bring that back.
That's such a great idea.
I love it.
A mobile stage. You just pull up and you got a stage and you can position it wherever you want, you know.
And it's great for that kind of music too. It's it's just a great presentation of that's one thing that we've talked about a lot with quite a few people who've come in here is it's one thing to be obsessed with music and to just have that love for it and to dedicate your life to the pursuit of just trying to improve at that. It's another skill set entirely to present it as a performer. And there's a lot of ways to do that, obviously, but whether it's something like the show track or just the working up the chops of being on stage and because we've all seen people on stage who, you know, may not be the most wizard-like in their technical abilities, but are just unbelievable performers. And, and that is a skill set in and of itself. And so anything like that in terms of framing and how you can present music, I'm always really interested in, because there's so many ways to do it. And I think the show track is just such a cool, cool component of that. It's just a great way to present that kind of music for people.
Yeah. I'm glad you see it that way. Yeah. It's fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's vintage. It was fun to be able to take it out to Bonnaroo.
Oh, very cool. And,
we were one of the stages of many stages at Bonnaroo.
Really? Oh, that's fantastic. When was that?
Like 3-4 years ago.
That's amazing. That's very cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, that was fun.
Are you a car guy in general, or is this just sort of a one-off interest?
Just a one-off, and then I got that. Then I got a 59 Lincoln Continental.
Okay.
Nice. Tasteful.
It needs... I was driving it, you know, when I got it. But then it needs some work now.
Gotcha.
Just working on that.
Gotcha. If you could, and I'm just, this is just a complete hypothetical, but I want to know this desperately. If you could go back in time and watch any number of performers, who would be at the top of your list? If you could just sit in the audience and watch some performer or band play, who are those people that you wish? Because I feel incredibly lucky. I mean, I've gotten to see so many people that I love, but there is that list of people that I think, God, if I could only sit in that theater and watch whoever. For you, who are those people?
Oh, I guess Django Reinhardt.
Oh,
that's a good first one.
That would be at the top of my list as well.
Yeah, yeah. He influenced everybody in a certain way, you know.
Yeah, Django's his DNA is in everything.
For sure.
He was
so ahead of his time.
He really was.
Like, if you listen, like, especially if you listen to other guitarists of his same era, he was like, you know, he
light
sounds like he was recorded, you know, 20 years later.
He really does.
He was really ahead of the pack as far as like the innovation of...
And taste. You can just listen to his tastefulness and just learn from that.
The only person I ever kind of... I can even compare him to in my head is like Charlie Christian, where obviously there's, you know, there's obviously with Charlie, there's also just the sort of moment of the time technologically and what he could do, which is fantastic. But just in terms of his melodic choices, it's... so unique, and it, to your point, Brian, it's so different from everything else happening around him that I feel the exact same way with Django. It's just, it's almost strange to listen to it in the context of the time. You think, where the hell did this come from? Like, people who can do that, I mean, not just this obviously goes beyond guitar players, but people who can do that in any facet of art, I'm always just, I mean, it's a constant reminder for me that those are the people that push. It's individuals who push us into the future. It's individuals who will, through just pure imagination and gritting their teeth, will get us to new places, which is amazing. It's just
through ignorance, I guess, and sometimes not knowing too much about anything else, you kind of come up with your own personality. And this is who you are, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I do hear like a lot of jazz in your playing. Is that like your main influence, like Django, or is there any other like big,
not necessarily. I'm a country guitar player.
Yeah.
But I like that sound. I like a few little notes here and there that
spice it up.
Stretch.
You know,
that's just how I like it. The sound, you know, absolutely. I don't want to be over the top, you know,
kind of
can't anyway, but be, just a country guitar player.
You know? Those kinds of sounds, I think, really meld well with, especially that more old school country sound.
Yeah.
And there's a long, at least in my head, there's a long
cornball country guitar, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, are you making fun of what you think country music ought to sound like? Or, you know?
Yeah.
But
it's
like Roy Nichols and people like that, you know, they're kind of real soulful in their playing.
And there is just something I find really, really fantastic about someone who sits with a particular type of music and really masters that thing. And this is true, again, this goes beyond music, but anyone who has the strength, the mental strength to sit with something and just try to master whatever that particular facet is of whatever that thing is that they're doing. I have so much respect for people who can do that because it's so hard. And that's, in a lot of ways, that goes against just sort of my personality and just my brain's all over the place, you know. But anytime anyone can do that, I'm just in awe of that. When someone can sit with a particular skill set and say, no, I'm going to get unbelievably good at this thing, this hyper-specific thing. And with country music, I mean, there's so many people who do that, and like that is what they do, and they're so good at it.
Yeah, I just like the songs, you know, the blue collar, the simplicity of what country music is, and then just kind of make that as cool as you can, mm-hmm. you know.
And with country music too, the thing that I just love more than anything is songwriting. I love putting songs together and taking them apart. And with country music, it's such a wonderful thing because the sort of core of the songs themselves are the foundation is so rock solid. I mean, there's, you know, the old adage, you don't need really any more than three chords. That's really all. Which there's
three chords in the truth.
Yeah, there's a little bit of, you know, as Woody Guthrie said, if you're playing more than two chords, you're just showing off. Which, I mean, there is.
You can always add more chords later.
No, that's exactly it.
You can take a Hank Williams song and make it into a pop song.
And that's what I love about country music is the songwriting is just so rock solid. And yet the presentation can be so vast. And there's so much you can do with presentation of a song and arrangement of a song. But when you strip it all back, that the core of that song is just so, it's like indestructible. And there's something really beautiful. I mean, I think Hank Williams is one of the best songwriters America's ever produced. And yeah. Those songs, yes, they can be, when you hear them in the context of a band, they can be far more sophisticated and they can be really musically interesting. But if you strip them down to what they are at their core, most of them are three chords with a phenomenal melody. And I just think there's something unbelievable in country music with that formula, whatever that is.
Yeah. Just down the basics.
Yeah.
That's the coolest thing to my ears, you know. I could listen to some jazz and I could equally listen to the Carter Family.
Yeah.
And still appreciate equally, you know.
Exactly.
I just love the simplicity, you know. There's a beauty to that, you know.
Totally.
It's beautiful. Absolutely. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It ain't ugly sounding. It's beautiful, you know.
When I first really got my first type of music that really drew me in and I got totally sucked into was like the blues. And, you know, like 90% of blues is all like basically the same progression. And like when you hear that, you would think like, oh, that must not be very good then, like it's all the same, because a lot of it is kind of the same, but there is you know, it's simplistic, but there's like a lot of beauty in the nuance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like it's all the same, but within those similarities,
five notes,
there's so many
the same. Exactly.
Yeah, there's so many little things.
Take those five notes make something out of that.
There's a lot of variation that can happen within that, you know, kind of smaller framework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, this past year, I went on tour in Norway with someone out here playing guitar for, and he is we actually had him on the show not too long ago, Rye Bradley. And Rye is a phenomenal, like, rock and roll guitar player. And it's the same kind of thing. It's like, I mean, that guy can play any style of music and he's just great. But that is the kind of music that he has clocked the hours in on. And it's the same kind of thing. It feels like at first glance, this is a relatively small sandbox. Mm-hmm. And then you realize the sandbox is 50 feet deep. And there's just so much that you can, dig up. And you can spend your entire life just working in that. You can spend your entire life working in that sandbox and never get bored. And I mean, I can't tell you how much I've learned from that guy and continue to learn from that guy. Cause it's just, there is something incredible about just sitting with a particular style of music and just digging and digging and digging.
It's not all just about technical. It's about putting a feel into putting yourself into those notes.
Yeah. I think country's kind of the same way where it's a small sandbox, but it's a very deep sandbox. That's a good analogy for sure.
And it's, so at this point in time, what is the music happening here that really excites you? Whether it's in this, traditional country scene here or just outside of it, what's the music that's happening around Nashville or beyond that just gets you excited for music?
Just the classic country stuff, like, you know, we talked about, and I'm kind of excited to finally maybe get going with music for the first time of my own, you know, and I get some things out there.
Cause you put out in the last couple of years, you've put out a couple singles. You've got, I mean, you have a ton of other stuff floating around obviously, but, so you've had, you know, you've been doing the studio work for a long time now, and that's really been, again, that's a huge contribution that you make to the scene here. Has it gotten under your skin? Like, I want to make some stuff and put it out there under my name. Is that kind of where you're at with it right now?
Yeah, I'm eking some things. I'm just getting some things out there, you know.
Yeah.
This year, I'm going to get some more things out there, some instrumentals and some new vocal tunes.
At least my understanding is the stuff that you've really put out under your name has been, my voice crack there. the stuff that you've put out under your name at this point has been original material. Is the intent to do more songwriting, or is it to do more arranging of other people's songs? What's kind of what's getting your goat right now?
Yeah, just doing the original tunes.
Nice.
And not just original tunes. There's so many tunes that I want to do. You know, you mentioned Ira Leuven.
Okay.
The Leuven brothers but we'll get some original tunes out there.
Nice.
I think
that's beautiful. Yeah.
Where the weight is, if you can do your own thing, you know?
Yeah. That's I think as long as you're in the present and as long as you're following whatever that thing is that you want to do, there's so many ways you can go, whether it's covering other people or putting your own stuff out. As long as it's what you want to do, I think people can smell that. You know what I mean? People can smell if people.
I'd like to do some tribute records. You know, like the when Jerry's still alive, I approached him. Was like, I'd like to do a picking on Jerry Reed. You know, and he thought that'd be a great idea. You ought to do that. And I still haven't done it. You know?
I love those solo guitar tunes. So you should put some of those out.
Yeah. Thanks.
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah. Brian and I would eat
solo
that.
Guitar
we
guy.
Would eat that up cool. as you put that out there. When you're arranging solo for solo guitar, I find there are so many different approaches people take with that kind of thing. This might be a little bit of inside baseball, but when you are arranging for solo guitar, what is your approach? Is it melody first and then stacking harmony? Is it how do you approach that? Because everyone does this differently, and I'm always intrigued by how everyone's brain tries to figure this puzzle out.
I guess there's no rules to it, you know. Mm-hmm. You come up with the melody, you come up with chords. You got a composition that could be just for solo guitar, then you got an instrumental that could be with a band, you know. I got some instrumentals that I would need a band to do it, you know.
Yeah.
I tend to go melody is obviously at the top, and then bass, and fill in the middle from there.
That makes sense.
I usually find, because I feel like, you know, the bass kind of keeps it, at least when you're playing solo, you need something kind of grounding it in a groove, you know what I mean? So I will usually learn a tune, just melody and bass. And then, like, I feel like everything in the middle is kind of like the ornamental kind of stuff, and I kind of fill it in from there.
We're just like going in a circle now. I tend to do a similar thing. I'll do melody first. Usually, I don't do a whole lot of solo arranging. It's few and far between. But when I do, it's usually traditional songs, and like that one I was playing earlier. And I'll tend to do melody first. But then I'm kind of a little different. I think guitar. I mean, guitar just sounds so good with open cowboy chords. I mean, it's just I can never get away from because it's just. They just resonate so, I mean, that's what guitar does. And so I always find it's then finding the right marriage of that and how do I want to, when do I want to move up the neck? What sounds, what inversions sound best with the melody. And I kind of almost do more chordal pairing with it than bass.
But you got all the things like counterpoint.
Yeah, exactly.
And harmonies and the weaving in and out of the melody, you know.
Yeah.
That makes it interesting. You could take just make a song out of two notes.
Exactly.
And build something around that, you know.
Totally, yeah.
Or just come up with a song title.
Yeah.
And then try to come up with something that goes with the title, you know.
Is that a technique you've done before or like?
Yeah, I've got a song. I got to put it down eventually. It's just, it's all like, it never really goes away from a half step. The melody is just a half step away, you know, from the next note. You know,
I would love to hear that.
Putting chords along that to make it work, you know.
Yeah.
And the title came first on that one.
No, I think I was just trying to.
Yeah, yeah. No, I find that interesting.
You know, don't go too far. Just a half step.
I'll write like my own solo guitar tunes, but because there's no lyrics, I always find it really hard to come up with a title for the song. And that just gave me the idea. Maybe I should just try it backwards, come up with a good title, and write the song after that.
Yeah, yeah.
That could work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do have to constantly remind myself that there are no rules. I think I'm pretty good with not following rules. So
it's just wherever the inspiration comes from.
Exactly. I think especially as I spent a lot of my day teaching, so I always. Again, this is something Brian and I have discussed, but I always think it's important to, I'm a big theory guy. It's been my entire life is just loving music theory. And, I always have to try and articulate to people that I think oftentimes when they start to learn about music theory, especially younger people, it can go over their head, or not because they can't get it, but because they think, I just want to play music. I don't really care about this. You know, it can seem like excess, but I always try and express them. You're not learning rules. If these were rules, music wouldn't be any fun. And I wouldn't be doing this with my life.
Mm-hmm.
These are just the patterns that have worked for people. And it's the way we talk about things.
Yeah.
And if you can look at it like that, it's so freeing because you're not sacrificing any level of imagination or spontaneity with what you're doing. You're just having a better understanding of what's worked for people and the language of music, how mm-hmm. we actually communicate these things. There's something really great about that. Do you find that you're, again, to kind of bring it back to what I was talking about a little bit earlier, a lot of people, I think, in this scene really respect, not just respect your career and you as a musician, but respect what you put into the music scene and how you help people out who love this kind of music. Do you get a kick out of that role, out of helping people out and showing them, hey, this is how I do. I mean, I think that's the coolest thing in the world. Like, does that resonate with you when you do that?
Sure. It's nice to see anybody carry on the music that you like, you know. Mm. I like talent.
Yeah.
I try to include myself in when I see some talent, you know. So yeah. I want to be part of that, you know. I got a studio, you know.
Yeah. Nice. When you're producing, just to kind of pivot a little bit, what are the skills that you have found work best for you when you're putting the producer hat on, when you're behind the board and trying to get something the way that you want it? Obviously that's a very, very different skill set than being a musician. What have you found you've kind of settled on? What's your approach when you have someone, when you're tracking someone in there, what's the way that you tend to approach that?
I guess it's very delicate because you're dealing with somebody's personality and their ego and it's like, what do I know? You know, but I can tell you what I'm thinking, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, you just sing if you, do you want to sing like you talk, you know, do you want to sing a certain, try to sound like that, you know, try to sound like, instead of trying to like sound like something that's not you coming out of your mouth. Like,
yeah.
You're talking to me in this voice and then you
singing this voice,
like that's fine. But, Is that the picture you're trying to paint, you know? Or yeah. You'd rather just be, you know, true to your voice.
Yeah.
Just stuff like that, you know?
That's wonderful. That's I think that's the stuff that goes the farthest when you're working with someone. There's something to be said about the more technical elements of production.
And you want to be able to understand the words. That's a big deal.
Absolutely,
And it's, for some reason, it takes a while for some people to... catch on to that.
It's diction, like, guys. It's all about diction.
I was like, I need to at least see the lyric sheet because I don't know exactly what say it's being when said here. You know,
when you're listening to a song, just as a consumer, as someone who loves music, whether it's in a professional setting where you're producing someone, or just as just a listener, what tends to be the first thing that's grabbing your ears? Is it melody? Is it lyrics? Is it the presentation itself? What tends to be the thing that you...
I have to admit, I'm probably lyrics last.
Brian's the same way. Brian's been playing as my guitar player now for more than a decade. I think he's the only guitar player I've played with in 10 years. And Brian, to this day, I don't think he could name you a single line in one of my songs.
No, I mean, lyrics obviously are very important. That's just my brain. Yeah. You know, I tune into a melody.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and the changes, because I'm an instrumentalist, you know.
I'm exactly the same way, and I feel like you're the only one you've had on the show that shares my same
and then you find
perspective.
Out what,
so
then
I appreciate
you find out
that.
What's being said, you know.
You're like, oh shit, I thought I liked this song.
I always just find like what resonates with me the most is like a good melody with, you know, the good harmony to match it. And if it has great lyrics, that's awesome, right? But for me, it's, you know, the composition of the song first. Lyrics are... Yeah, I respect the art of writing lyrics.
Everybody's different in that department, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it is very different. I find it's all about melody and lyrics. Everything else I love. I love the presentation of things. But to me, that's all secondary. It's like, is the melody and the lyrics, do they work in the way that I want them to work? And then...
But sometimes you can't help but hear the lyrics because it's so glued to the melody.
Absolutely.
It's like, it's fixed. There's a note that this word goes to. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't change
it. And my songerwriting
like a Beatles,
brain, that's...
Beatles song or something, you know.
To
yesterday,
me, that's the best.
You know.
That is the that is the best songwriting. That is what I strive for every time I write a song. I do think that there is a magic between the interplay... The relationship between melody and lyrics, and it's little things where for those, you know, for people who don't have a musical mind or don't have interest in songwriting or whatnot, it can seem ridiculous, but it is the difference between one syllable or one word or whatever it might be. It's these tiny little moments that make the magic or break the magic. And when it works, it's just stunning. When it works, it's the most beautiful thing in the world to me. But it's so hard. I mean, there's nothing like we were talking about Roger Miller earlier. I think Roger Miller is just
a
phenomenal songwriter. And he's one of those people like you cannot change a word. It's not gonna work, or it's not gonna resonate in the same way that it does, because that checklist is there.
It goes with melody too.
Exactly. And there's some songwriters who can do that.
You can't really have a song without the note.
Yeah.
Without the notes, you know.
Exactly.
You
just
have a poem, you know.
Exactly. But it's that marriage, it's that relationship between the two when people can
sometimes
do that,
you got a melody
amazing.
That's just kind of throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one kind of melody. Then you got a melody that actually it works with those words and those syllables, you know.
It is really, I think also working the English language is fascinating because we have so many ways of saying the same thing. I mean, English is such a unique language for a lot of different reasons, but there are so many synonyms. There are so many turns. There are so many turns of phrases. There are so many ways that you can present the same idea. And it's those little idiosyncratic choices that that can sometimes make, that can make music and can also make it work or not work with a melody. And that I just think is...
And then the production, and then you're painting a picture of the mood.
Yeah.
You know, with the weaving of the chords.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love, I think harmony is just...
You can do a lot. You can take a song that doesn't seem like anything and make it into something.
Bring it to life. Well, good harmonies brings a song to life.
Totally.
By a production, you know.
Yeah, I always find that that's, to me at least, most apparent with standards. There are some... I mean, if you just look at the American Songbook, there's beautiful melodies in there on their own. Just you could play them on a saxophone; they're going to sound stunning.
And then you got the quality of the singer, you know.
Yes.
And one of my favorite singers is a friend of mine, Sierra Farrell.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
She's probably a favorite.
Amazing.
Of so many
yeah,
people.
Great singer.
And she could sing anything. So mm-hmm. just, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Just if you got a voice,
yeah,
you're gonna.
You can bring it to life.
It's going to sell, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to make this thing
work. There are so many components.
Yeah.
Yeah, so many components at play when you're dealing with music. And when it does come to life, it is just, it's beautiful. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. So when Timbo was on here, we got into a whole thing about, I'm sure you know, like there's certain players or vocalists or whomever who... you know, can play something that's so simple, but for whatever reason, it just sounds so much better than, you know, anyone else who would play it. And I think that is really what separates a lot of the best players from other people. And sometimes it's hard to pinpoint, like, what it is that...
Yeah.
Like, what if you had to put it in your words, like, what would you say is that kind of... thing that, you know, someone can just play something so simple and for whatever reason it's so much better than other players.
You hear it, you don't know what it is. It's a feel.
Yeah,
you know, you hear that feel, inflection mm-hmm. going between the notes. It's like, it makes you cry, you know. It's like, I don't know what you're, you know.
Yeah, it's almost
whatever,
like
you're doing
little,
is working, you know.
Mm-hmm. Some mystical magic to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think time's definitely a big one. Like rhythmic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Time is so unique in music because you can write something down on a staff and understand, okay, I get the gist of how this is flowing. It's another thing when you do exactly that, when you bring it to life and you put real time into it where I think you can teach that. It's really, really hard to teach that. It's so hard to teach that. And when people are good at that, it is just...
It's not how much you play. It's the, you know,
yes,
like
exactly.
They say, the silence between the notes.
Exactly. You
know, there's something definitely to that.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I think, I mean, a good example of that would be, I think B.B. King would probably be a really good example of that. I think, honestly, all the Kings. Freddie, maybe more than anyone. But, I mean, yeah, I don't say probably Freddie. Just the way that you can... The way that you can phrase something on paper may not be anything blowing your mind, but when it's that person communicating it in that way,
you sing it. You could sing it different, different every time.
Yeah, I mean that's the scary part of music to me. I mean that really is the.
It's hard to pinpoint what that is.
You can sing the same melody. And the words different every time by phrasing, you know.
Yeah,
you know.
That is what my favorite musicians do. Whatever world they work in, whatever genre they work in, whatever, you know, style of music it is they're playing. That is the through line that I found in music is that creative impulse to. It's not going to sound the same way twice, and that's beautiful, and that's the way it's supposed to be. And again, that's dependent on the kind of music you're playing, and mm-hmm. there's different for different people. But I just. When people can do that, to me, that's the skill set that I'm in awe of, when people can make that fresh.
Yeah, it's sort of jazz.
Yeah, you know? No, exactly. it could be Willie Nelson, or it could be whoever. It could be Grant Green. It doesn't matter. It's that ability to be so present with a piece of music that you can't help but bring it to life in your own way.
Mm-hmm.
What, obviously you've done a lot of music over the course of your life and you've gotten a chance to just do a lot of really cool things in this world. But what's the, what is the music that you look back on and you feel the most proud of? I mean, it's, it might seem like a silly question because there's more, more, so much more music ahead of you, but what's the stuff when you think, what's the stuff that you think about? You think, God, I'm proud I made that just as a musician. And it doesn't, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't matter if there's two people in the room or not, but what's the stuff that, that sticks with you?
Kind of sad, but you know, maybe just a few things, maybe instrument. I think what's, I got a lot ahead of me, you know, so I think that's, mm-hmm. I'm looking forward.
Yeah.
But, just a few things maybe that I've written.
Yeah.
Stuff I would get to be a part of in the studio, and like with Jerry. Jerry would come in and we'd record some stuff. That was important to me.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I find it, it's usually specific moments where you, where that music does come to life. Mm-hmm. And you feel like, I don't know why that worked in that moment and it didn't in the next moment. But that's fantastic.
It's fun to cut live. It's always fun to be able to cut everybody in the same room. Mm-hmm. And basically halfway have it mixed,
yeah,
going down.
That's the way to do it, especially for that kind of music. That's the way to do it.
Yeah. Totally. A friend of mine, I guess it's okay for me to say, I think we're going to work on another album. Dave Peterson, he likes to record everything like that. Everything is live in, mm-hmm. in the same room. He even still likes to use the tape machine,
nice.
The 2-inch tape machine.
There you go.
So it doesn't get turned down a whole lot. Turned on a whole lot, you know.
Yeah, that's
but
that's,
something magic happens when you got to get it.
Mm-hmm. No, I completely agree. I think that's the way to do it.
You can't go back unless we all cut it together again. Yeah. You know,
there is something about having everyone in the same room, a live take that you kind of, you know, you only get with everyone in the same room playing together.
Yeah,
to me, that's the magic of music. It's the presence. It's everyone.
It doesn't have to be that way.
No, absolutely, it's absolutely not. But I guess when I say that, I mean the magic to me is the being present in that moment. And that can happen if you're overdubbing a guitar solo. But I think it can be the most visceral when it's people in a room playing off of each other.
Yeah.
It's the same reason I love watching live music. I love watching people get lost in the moment. And I don't think there's really anything... I don't think there's anything else really like that, but
there's the over guitar players are the worst when it comes to overdubs.
Oh,
yeah. I mean me, you know, it's like it'll take 20 takes.
Oh yes, that's why I don't let Brian overdub. Back.
Oh, the first one was the best.
Oh, don't even get me started. Yeah,
there you go.
My recordings take a whole lot of takes. She
can attest to it.
She can tell you.
Well, I got to say, Mark, this was really fantastic to have you on. It was
great to be here.
It was really a lot of fun.
I'm honored to be here.
No, I was going to say, it really is an honor to have you here, and we had a ball. So thank you so much for doing this. And
thanks, guys.
And I'm excited to hear what you got coming out next. So appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Cool.
That was fun. That was great, man. Thank you, really, again. Like, that was fantastic. It was nice to just make your brain.
You ready to record it now?
Yeah. All right, now we're starting. It was just so great to see.